Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo Is There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Lisa Andreasen, and we are going to be discussing The Gods Themselves by Isaac Asimov, which won the 1973 Hugo Award for Best Novel. So, Lisa, thank you for joining me.
Oh, thank you for letting me join you.
Yes. And maybe you should say your full name, just in case I mispronounced it badly. Yep.
Lisa Andreasen.
Nice. And you are my first guest from Denmark, mm-hmm. which is awesome. Mm-hmm. Also, as far as I know, my first guest to read the book in a foreign language, mm-hmm. a non-English language, I should say. And so we'll talk about that, I'm sure. But why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay, the short version is I've been a science fiction fan since, since I saw Raumschiff Enterprise in German television and Doctor Who and stuff like that. Actually, I watched Doctor Who when I was too young. I became scared. Watching it, had to stop. I have a sneaking suspicion that my father was a science fiction fan without ever saying it like that. But I think I was watching science fiction because he liked it. Mm. He didn't know German, so I don't know what he got out of Star Trek. But in school, we had some good books. We had a good librarian. He helped me find the good books. So I read Tolkien and Le Guin and Clarke. Again, I read 2001 when I was too young. I had to shut down, I don't know, halfway through the book because I got scared. Mm. And then we read Lord of the Flies as part of the Danish curriculum. Mm-hmm. And it's actually interesting to hear podcasts about what Americans read in school, like they've read The Lottery and mm-hmm. things like that, because we didn't. We had a different mm-hmm. curriculum. So the classics is differently defined here. Yes, I started using the real library. And when I ran out of horse books, I found the science fiction shelves. I mostly read short stories. I don't know. There's something nice about an anthology or a collection. If you don't like one short story, you can just read the next. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of classics at that point, and I'm sure I read iRobot at that point. Then when I came to high school, my boyfriend at the time suggested that I read Foundation, and I did, and it was so good, and it was my breakthrough into novels. Mm. So I read a lot more novels at that point. Okay, Star Trek. Star Trek The Next Generation coincided with my studies at university, 87 to 94. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I watched. And again, I watched them in German at first. Yeah, I'm a Trekkie through and through. there's so much. When I discuss science fiction, I so often come back to Star Trek as an example of how science fiction should be and what it is to me and so on. Right. While I was studying, I started reading books in English. I started with Discworld. I also started buying my own books. And Asimov was the first author where I said, it would be nice to have everything he ever wrote. Again, I loved the short stories because there would be anecdotes about why he wrote that short story or whatever he wanted to mention, and I loved it. Just loved it. But I read the robot books, Foundation books, and so on. And then, I don't know, it's just grown. I'm mm-hmm. still reading a lot. I'm watching television. I'm watching movies. I've been a member of Trekkies.dk. Currently, I'm a member of Science Fiction Circle. I write about science fiction. I write science fiction. I attend cons. I organize cons. I've attended three world cons so far.
Nice. And you are in translation as well, right?
I do translation. Yeah. Yes. I've translated a collection of Benjamin Rosenbaum into Danish. Yeah.
Nice. You had sent me a video a while back that the link doesn't seem to work anymore. I know you're working on that. Talking about kind of peculiarities of translation. And there was a Star Trek analogy in there for Mr. Data take the helm, which was very funny. Yeah. Data with a medieval helmet.
Yeah. Yeah, because and there's a super translation thing with the gods themselves. It's for some reason a supernova turns into a super wagon. I'm not sure what the translator was thinking there. So,
well, a Chevy Nova is a famously bad car in the United States.
I don't know.
Interesting. Have you tallied up your how many Hugo winners you've read?
Yes. Okay. I've read 35, including one of the latest is They'd Rather Be Right. No, actually, I didn't read that. I tried reading it. I've read 35, and I've tried reading three more. And by tried reading, I mean gave up. I just don't like this book. Mm-hmm. So
you know, there's only so much time, and I'm really coming around to the idea that not finishing a book that you're not enjoying is just a good life decision. And unless, of course, you've set yourself the project to read them all, in which case, eventually, I'll have to do them. So I'm up to 58. So
yes, yeah. I've read a lot of these books because they are classics, and lately I've been reading a lot of them because they were Hugo nominated. Like I read The Fifth Season because it was not, but because it won.
Do you typically read them in translation, or do you read them in English?
No.
Okay. But this one in particular, well, I guess that's where we should move into, like, the history with this title. You know, why this book?
Well, as I mentioned, I'm very much into Asimov, and this is an unusual book from him. He had been teased that he never wrote about sex and never wrote about aliens, and this was his chance to take revenge.
He made up for it.
Yeah. And especially the middle part, I really like it. It's so alien. That they have to invent different words to sort of describe their situation and so on. I really loved it.
Yeah.
So a favorite book from a favorite author.
Okay. Well, why don't we go ahead and move into kind of our non-spoiler discussion.
Yeah.
And that starts with, if you want to describe the plot without getting into too many spoilers.
Yeah.
Which probably, like you mentioned over email, probably means talking a little bit about the first and second part, but maybe not the third.
Okay, this story has a few ingredients, such as tungsten, impossibly, spontaneously, being replaced with plutonium-186, an impossible isotope. And this plutonium driving a pump, producing so-called free energy. All this implies the existence of a paramen in the para-universe, the source of all this impossibleness. The process of turning tungsten into plutonium is also the process of the net loss of 20 electrons for each atom. And that's a loss from the universe. We just lost 20 electrons. So far, this has had consequences like our magnetosphere is growing. The consensus is that the future will deal with that problem.
Right.
Professor Hallam is universally accepted as the inventor of the pump. It's very touchy when people question this. Peter Lamont is writing a history of the pump, and he happens to question what everybody knows. And hey, arch enemy created. Myron Brunowski is trying to decode a message from the paramin. Lamont and Brunowski have reason to believe that the future will deal with that problem isn't good enough.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Dua, an emotional, ponders her life and behaves in a strange way. She is in a relationship with Odin, a rational, and Trit, a parental. Yeah.
Yeah. And they are what in our universe they call the paramen, right?
Yeah.
Which of course that's how they would refer to people in the other universe, gender them.
para people? Yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
Right. Para people would make more sense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's good. And the title derives from Friedrich Schiller's Against Stupidity, the Gods Themselves Contend in Vain. And so this is a fix-up book, right? It's kind of made of three different stories.
But I think he had in mind to release it as a book.
Yeah.
After.
Yeah, yeah. I think so. Rather than like the Foundation novels where they were published serially, that kind of thing.
And then later. So. Yeah. And actually, interestingly, the middle part wasn't published in the same magazine as the first and third part.
Oh.
So if you only subscribe to one magazine, you would only get one part of the story. You would either get only the humans or you would get only the para people.
That's interesting. I didn't know about that.
Weirdly unusual. I think it's because Galaxy and If were considered sort of almost the same magazine.
So. Yeah, I'm sure they had similar subscriber lists. Yeah.
I think they had the same editor as well.
Okay, interesting. Yeah, so overall thoughts on this one. I really enjoyed the first part. It is pretty heavy into the science. I have no idea how accurate the science is. Probably not super accurate, but although, you know, who knows? But like you said, the second part was the part that I really enjoyed. It is really very alien, trying to come up with aliens that are not humanoid. Although you could make an argument that the so-called hard ones in the other universe may be ambulatory the way that we are.
Yeah.
But who knows? The third part bogged down a little bit for me. It's okay. And it's a decent conclusion to the novel, but really I enjoyed the first two parts the most.
Okay. Yeah.
And like you mentioned, a lot of sex talk in this novel.
Second
not so
and
much
third,
in the first part.
No, second and third part have,
Yeah. So in terms of, and you've already given your kind of overall thoughts about it, a favorite book from a favorite author. But is there anything else you want to mention?
I think it's rare to find a book that's good at really alien aliens.
Yeah.
There's a reason that we mock Star Trek, where aliens are simply people with plastic masks.
Right.
Because so many aliens are actually very, very human. These are not. It's so refreshing.
Right.
And then also, Asimov, so many of his stories were mysteries, even when they were labeled as science fiction. So there's a very strong element here of what's actually going on. Why do we meet these people? Oh, the para people. What's going on in their end? How can they push plutonium on us? And so on and so on. Trying to figure out what's actually going on is a big part of it. And he was very good at it.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to save, there's something that I wanted to mention, but I think I want to save that for spoilers. But in terms of comps for this novel or, you know, similar novels or television programs, do you have anything that you can compare it to?
Yeah, it's sort of a cop-out to say that if you like Asimov, you're going to like this as well. Part of his, a few of his short stories are about a fictitious element he called theotimolin. And it has the ability to dissolve in water before it actually hits the water. So you can use it for time travel and stuff like that. And of course, he was, I think he was a biochemist or something by education. So he could really write these stories complete with footnotes and references and everything. If you like those stories, you're going to like some of this as well. He has scientists fighting, scientists getting good jobs, not because they do good science. I think there are bits of that in Foundation as well. If you like that kind of stuff, go ahead. Trying to communicate with aliens as they do in the first part, of course, reminds me of Arrival, Contact, books and movies like that. If you don't like stories with no women, don't read this.
Right. I think in the first part of this book there may be one woman mentioned, but she never speaks.
No.
And then in the second you have a character referred to as she. Can you call her a woman? It's also a little weird that she's the emotional and therefore the female, I guess.
On the other hand, the parental is a he, so he did twist it a little.
He did. And you can definitely, I feel like, and I want to talk about this more in spoilers, you can you can apply differences in like gender fluidity to the kind of triad relationship that they have in the para universe. I want to pull on that thread a little bit at some point, but not a lot of female characters. And then there's Selene in the third part, who's a strong character, but you know, doesn't have any other women to talk to.
Oh, yeah. I think she has a colleague or something, but yeah.
Yeah. In terms of comps, the only one I could think of was the Conqueror's trilogy by Timothy Zahn, where the first book in that series is told entirely from the human perspective, and then the second book shifts and essentially retells the story from the alien perspective. Mm-hmm. And then the third one kind of blends them. I expected something like that in this one. We didn't really get that blending in the third part. The third part in this one goes back to just talking to humans, or having humans being the focal point. So, and I think I would have liked that. I think I would have liked it if the third part went back and engaged the para-universe again.
It is a very thin connection we have with the para-universe.
Yeah.
It is possible to communicate, but only with a few written notes, so...
Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about before we get into spoilers?
Have you considered that Odin, Dua, and Trit might be alien words for 1, 2, and 3?
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you mention it, it's kind of obvious, isn't it?
Also, I have a hard time pronouncing Dua right. Maybe it should be Dua, but Dua, I go to Italian, and I think that would be Dua. So, I don't know.
Yeah. How many languages do you speak?
Oh, God. Danish, of course. English, like a second language. I've spoken it so much, written so much. So I may be a little rusty today, but a lot. German, certainly I can carry a conversation. French, a little. Swedish, a little. Norwegian, a little. and then we're down to, you know, words, phrases, bits, pieces.
Right. Yeah.
So
then you're down to where Americans typically are. I can say a few words and phrases in Japanese and German.
Yeah, stuff like that.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, I say we go ahead and walk over into spoilers.
Yes.
Okay, so freeform discussion, anything you want to talk about. We can talk about the different parts of the book individually, if you like, or just do whatever you want to do.
Yeah. Well, we already have mentioned women. So Selene, who is young, with breasts. This is from the third part, on the moon. Selene and Baron Neville, Ben Dennison, who was actually mentioned in the first part. Mm-hmm. He is not so young, and they form a relationship.
Right.
And it's just, it's so typical. This older man, very scientific, maybe with glasses, and young, beautiful woman pairing up.
Right.
It's also
Of course, wears almost nothing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Asimov does it too in Foundation's Edge and Foundation and Earth. There's also this older guy, younger woman. I don't like it.
Yeah. In Foundation's Edge, don't they find a way to de-age the guy at some point? I feel like they do.
I can't remember
if it's that book or something else.
Yeah. No, that's actually, they'd rather be right.
Exactly, that's what I was thinking of, was they'd rather be right.
Oh, and also she says that people on the moon don't have sex with people from Earth. And to me, you don't have enough imagination. If the problem is that the man from Earth flails, tie him down.
Right.
God, what's the problem here? I mean, and of course, Asimov didn't think like that, and it wasn't as wide known as it is now, but oh, come on.
Right. Well, I mean, there is an interesting kind of hard science fiction idea about that someone emigrating from the Earth to the moon, for instance, and the book mentions it, might have a hard time staying in their bed overnight, because tossing and turning in Earth gravity is one thing, and on the moon, you could find yourself flying out onto the floor.
Yeah.
And that's fun, but of course they had to bring it back to sex.
There's also this whole idea that if you go to the moon, you find the gravity weird, you find the food weird, you find the air weird, and so on and so on. I just reread The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, and it has exactly the same things.
Yeah.
So it was very people thought that was how it's going to be. And what do I know? We haven't made a base there yet, so I don't know.
Right. Yeah, the discussion of the different ways of moving on the moon, the kangaroo step, where you know, it's essentially kind of double-footed. The way I picture fauns or satyrs in the Chronicles of Narnia, I kind of picture them moving that way as well. But I guess they would do it alternating leg, but I figured that I'd picture the movement that way. Or like a deer, I guess, if you've ever seen a deer kind of hopping from one place to another.
Yeah, and the idea that people on the moon, if you're born on the moon, you will be tall and thin.
Yeah, that's a very familiar kind of spacers versus earthers thing down to the Expanse series and in Asimov's, what series is the Elijah Bailey, R. Danilo Oliva,
The Cage of Steel, robot? That series.
I've definitely read that in a lot of places, right? Differences in gravity, it makes sense. Because I remember reading a thing about a scientist betting someone that he was taller laying down than standing up. And the guy was like, that's nonsense. And it turns out that when you lie down, you actually do your spine relaxes a little bit because it's not being pressed down.
Yeah.
And so you are measurably taller lying down. Not by very much, but
we are taller in the morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Gravity beats us down all day.
Yeah.
One thing I wanted to ask you was about the pronunciation of Selene, because in the book, as an English reader, and he plays this trick on you, because you're reading it as Selene until you find out how it's pronounced.
Yeah.
I was curious how that translated in Danish, because there's a joke in there where someone says, did you sell any? Sell any of something.
Oh.
And I didn't know if that joke translated in Danish.
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Huh. And that makes sense.
Yes, it would be hard to translate. I really fought to learn her name. Like I had to go to Helena because it has sort of the same rhythm.
Yes.
But this Selene, that it ends on an R. I really had to fight to learn that. On the other hand, it makes total sense. If everybody's and their sister is named Selene and Selena and so on, you start exploring different pronunciations.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, we left sex a little too quickly because been in part two. So much sex. And do you know that sex makes you smarter?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, I did want to circle back and talk for a while about the second part, because that was my favorite part of the book. It sounded like it was your favorite part of the book as well.
Yeah, yeah.
It's probably ahead of its time in a lot of ways, right? Mm-hmm. With having the aliens that kind of melt into each other and form in mating triads. Mm-hmm. But like you said, the whole idea that they come together in what they call melting, and at least one of them gets smarter during that time. was fascinating. I feel like if it were written today, there would be a little more creativity with the gendering of the characters, because you wouldn't have, male, female, male sandwich kind of thing. Mm. You could take on the idea that, is it accurate to call Trit and Odin male and Dua a female? I'm not sure it really is accurate.
Mm.
Differing physiology, I'm sure.
Yeah. I think if I was doing it now, I would either stick with left, right, mid, or invent three new pronouns.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's a good point, that he does use that term, right? Left, right, and mid. Of course, it's still almost heteronormative, where there are roles for each, right? Yeah. The left, right, and mid are defined roles with the rational, emotional, and parental, right?
Yeah.
And Dua is the most interesting character in the book.
Yeah.
By quite a margin, for me anyway. The fact is that she is an emotional who has rational tendencies.
Yes. Yes.
And they call her a left M.
Yes.
And of course that's a derogatory, and it's the kind of thing that would, I guess little children, even in the para universe, are mean to each other. But it's the tendency to exclude the different, right?
Yeah, yeah. She is very different. She almost understands everything Odin says.
Yeah.
The other emotionals are described as blondes. They say bubbleheads.
Yes.
They giggle. Mm-hmm. And then they go home and have sex. Right. And she's different.
It was also, so talking about the alien sex, there's down to alien sex, alien masturbation, mm-hmm. apparently, yeah. and some other kind of illicit thing where Odin and Trit are touching each other.
Yeah.
And there's passages that just, they read like romance novels, like bad romance novels, and talking about, you know, it was bound to continue happening and Odin was bound to give in. He always did. It was something that was sure to happen, even to the most self-conscious rational. As the old saying had it, everyone either admitted doing it or lied about it. There was skin-deep penetration, and Odin could feel the pulsing of Trit's hard surface under the skin. There was enjoyment riddled with guilt. So there was an IO9 article that I found. The title was Isaac Asimov's The Gods Themselves, in which scientists are jerks and aliens masturbate.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he actually tried to imagine, okay, if the para-universe is able to push plutonium on us, mm-hmm. the atoms are further apart, and you really see that with the young people because they can mix, they can blend. Right. They're like mm-hmm. gas. What would sex be like for people mm-hmm. like that? So he yeah. really tried to stretch there. Mm-hmm. And then he still has things like partners fight. You have to bring up children. There's a right way to do things. Like the parental will say, stop going into the wall. You know that grown-ups don't do that. And that feels so familiar.
Yeah, yeah. And where the left and the right are constantly frustrated that the mid doesn't want to melt. Right?
Yeah.
Kind of the mismatched libidos, I guess you could call it.
Yeah.
I did think there is kind of a twist, right, where you find out what the relationship between the soft ones and the hard ones is.
Yeah.
Because there's, is it Dua who has the idea, or was it Odin that had the idea that the soft ones are just machines, essentially engineered by the hard ones to serve a purpose and then pass on, right?
Yeah, yeah. When did you figure it out, what this passing on business is?
He was gradually figuring it out, right? Because and I think he got hints from one of the other hard ones. Mm-hmm. Although they're not supposed to get the hints. They're supposed to pass on and become the hard ones after they discover that for themselves because they've matured to that stage. Yeah. And I did think it was a good twist that there's the one, what was the name of the hard one that they wanted to talk to? Estvald, right? Mm, yeah. That they wanted to influence to find out about, hey, how can we shut down they called it the positron pump, of course, mm-hmm. where on the Earth side, it's the electron pump. Mm-hmm. And then they find out right at the end as they pass on and become Estvald, the hard one. They didn't realize until that point that they actually are that one, which was, it was a solid twist.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I had read it before. I could sort of remember where it was going. So I was mm-hmm. curious when you figured it out.
I didn't really figure it out. I think I had the idea that the soft ones individually became hard ones, but I didn't. Ah. It didn't cross my mind that the triad would turn mm-hmm. into the hard one. So, mm. and that's just it's alien enough that I didn't go there immediately. So, mm-hmm. I'll give them credit for a well executed twist there.
Yep.
And of course, on their side, in the first part, you have Lamont? Yeah, Lamont, who suspects that. And it's motivated reasoning for him. He suspects that the electron pump may not be just this wonderful free energy for all thing that humanity didn't really come up with this. We weren't smart enough to come up with this on our own. And the fact that it was done with the consultation and not consultation, but was offered to us by the para-universe is suspicious to him. There's no such thing as a free lunch. That's a saying that we have, right?
Yep.
And so he hates Hallam. And so he's motivated to find something bad about this. So he realizes that along with the transfer of particles, we may be transferring underlying laws of the universe, underlying constants in the universe, like the strong nuclear force. And so that if we keep doing this long enough, that it will strengthen the strong nuclear force in our universe and turn our sun from the way it is now to one that will go supernova and in the short term. Yeah. And that's an interesting and frightening possibility, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I was curious if we would find out, is that actually true? And we do find out in the second part that, yes, mm-hmm. that is true. And that's exactly what they're hoping for.
Yeah.
Because then they'll be able to draw on that energy for thousands of years, I think, right?
Yeah. It would be much easier if we just exploded.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, because I get the impression that their sun is on its way out. Is cooling.
Right? They need free energy is nice for us, but they really need it. They're dying.
Yeah, their life cycles are changing essentially.
Yeah, and there are fewer of them. They're apparently not, there's not enough energy to drive them. So they're like, oh, we used to be tens of thousands of us, and now we are just.
Yeah. Did you get the impression? I was reading something else about this, and their impression was that these aliens were aquatic. And so when you hear about Dua going to the surface, it's the surface of water, where I was picturing them being in caves.
Yeah, me too. Though it is a strange kind of cave, the rock is permeable right. for them as well. So it's not quite our kind of cave, but I saw it as, you know, surface rock, sun, air.
Of course, you know. Melting into the rock or rock rubbing is a taboo.
yeah, sure. Don't do that.
Yeah.
Proper people don't do that.
Nope.
I find it interesting that Estwald is so dedicated to this pump and mm-hmm. Dua is the opposite. She's frightened.
Yeah.
We can't do this to other people. We can't just let them explode. Because I don't quite know what it says about the hard one, because it must be made up of the free individuals.
Yeah,
and Dua sort of drowns in that.
Yeah, maybe it's the it's an analogy to the pushing down of female voices.
Oh, yeah. Maybe.
I mean, if you look at the history of science, right? They not even just female voices, but the voices mm-hmm. Of the commoners, right? Scientist was considered to be a gentleman's pursuit in the kind of in the Middle Ages and on. And so someone like Michael Faraday, just brilliant scientist, but he needed Humphrey Davy to be there to kind of help him publish, even though he was a lot smarter than Humphrey Davy. Mm. So, but the pushing down of the voices of the undesirable people.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Then there's the part where Trit tricks Dua into becoming very she wants sex, and you know what, Trit, that's abuse.
It is, yeah. That was disturbing.
Yeah, it's adjacent to rape. What Trit does
very
there.
Much, yeah, absolutely. And it's not presented as a good thing either.
No,
right?
No.
The author is not approving of that.
No, Trit is just so single-minded.
Yes. Yeah, well, he's very, what are we doing here if we're not producing our, I think they had already produced two children, but they need to produce three, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Dua has been fighting this because she doesn't want to die or whatever.
To pass on, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's realized that her usefulness is only, not usefulness, but her kind of existence is leading to that third child, and then they'll pass on, and she doesn't want to do that. Anything else you want to talk about the second part?
No, I think I'm ready to move on.
Okay. I mean, we didn't talk much about the first part. There's not that much to it. It's just there's the kind of discussion of what the process is for the electron pump happening with the tungsten and the plutonium.
Yeah.
And that was fascinating. And I feel like people who really like a book like The Martian or Project Hail Mary by Andy Weir, they'd like those parts, even though I'm not certain. I haven't asked any physicists. Is this accurate? You know, could we mine energy this way? Or I don't know. It doesn't matter.
Ask a physicist about the natural laws gradually entering our universe, and they will say, no, stop right there. No, the thing about scientists fighting, I think that's very accurate,
yes,
unfortunately.
Yes, very much. Yeah, and kind of going back to what I was talking about Faraday and Davy, you know, or even if you look at the history of Antoine Lavoisier, who isolated oxygen for the first time and then ended up being executed during the purge in France.
Okay.
He was sent to the guillotine.
Yeah.
And because of jealousy on the part of another scientist. he was denounced.
Yeah.
Horrifying.
Yeah, Edison famously stole ideas from everywhere.
Oh, yeah, he was terrible.
Yeah.
I read a book called AC/DC that was about the kind of the fight between Edison and Westinghouse on whether the power systems would be on alternating current or direct current.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And, yeah, the things that they did to make alternating current look dangerous, they executed an elephant using alternating current to show, see, it's so dangerous it can be used to kill, as if direct current couldn't also kill. But yeah, definitely scientists fighting is, it's if you look at the history of science, you see a lot of it. So quite accurate. So in the third part, it's still an interesting book. And that part, if there was a part of the book that was a slog, it was the third part for me, because there was asides about acrobatics on the moon. And how an Earthman, you know, would probably never learn to do those moves, you know. Interesting, but it didn't really drive the plot forward all that much.
No.
And then a lot of dwelling on essentially the nudist colony that is the moon.
Yes. Although you mentioned that you expected the third part to be a blend between humans and aliens. And the moon people sort of are aliens. They are different.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah. I hadn't considered it that way.
Yeah. And Selene keeps saying, you just don't understand us. You just don't get us. You don't have our point of view. Mm-hmm. And you never will.
Right.
And especially Selene turns out to be very different, because she has this intuition thing. She can talk to a physicist and then say, maybe if you do this, it will work. Maybe you can do a new, maybe you can invent something new if you do it like this. So Selene is our own, not doer, but someone very special.
Yes. And I think they had kind of given the impression that, her intuitionist tendencies are the result of genetic engineering from in the past. There was some talk earlier in the book that that's all been outlawed.
Yeah. Humans try to use eugenics to or something to create intuition, which is actually interesting, because Dua and Odin and Trit are also the result of eugenics, and them pairing up is the result of eugenics. I don't know whether it do it all the time, but this pairing trio was the result of choice. You are very special. If we combine you, you will turn out very special.
Mm-hmm. The kind of the human refusal to believe that the pump is dangerous is directly applicable to climate change.
Oh, yes.
And the quote that I got, I think it was from Denniston, was saying, or Denniston, the easiest way to solve a problem is to deny it exists. And that hits hard, and that is still very true today.
Yeah.
One of the things that I really enjoyed was the argument that, and I think this was, I can't remember if it was Denniston or if it was Selene or if it was a combination, with the argument that if there is another universe, a para-universe, then there are probably infinite numbers of them. Mm-hmm. With, and where the para-universe and our universe are kind of on opposite ends of the spectrum, you could look at our universe as being in the middle, and then there will be another one even further out. So that rather than having a, like the para-universe has a strong nuclear force, a stronger, strong nuclear force, ours has a weaker one, and there must be ones further back or on the other end of the spectrum with even weaker. And so that's where they discovered the cosmic egg universe, where it's all basically pre-Big Bang that they can then kind of do mine the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And counteract the electron pump.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a discussion that two is an impossible number.
Yeah. There's some double dealing going on with the they call it the Cosmeg pump station, where Denniston thinks he's doing something to counteract the electron pump. But in fact, what is the name of the other Baron?
Baron Neville.
Neville, yes.
Yeah.
He wants to move the moon. He wants to use it to move the moon.
Yeah.
And I wasn't totally sure I understood his motivations.
I think he has a problem. He should get therapy.
I think that's accurate.
That's Because to him, the moon is to live in caves, and the ultimate cave is so far away from the Earth that you have to stay in the cave.
Yeah, and so then the electron pump, right, he wanted pumping stations on the moon in order to keep them from dependence on the sun, right, because their energy is all provided by solar batteries and solar arrays and that kind of stuff.
And they're also dependent on vacuum, I think, and low temperatures.
Yeah, so... I feel like the third part could have been its own novel.
Oh,
and, you know, most of what is there could be expanded, and some of it's just kind of poked at briefly, but we don't get a whole lot of development about where Neville is really coming from, other than, like you said, he definitely needs to see a psychiatrist.
Mm. I thought it was interesting that the third part was in a third location.
Yes.
And it made sense to me that if you have this problem that the laws of the laws of nature are changing, and they're doing it gradually. Mm-hmm. You don't want the two pumps too close together, because it would go boom between them. You want you want some kilometers between them. And you use kilometers too, don't you? You're so close to Canada.
No, we don't.
Oh, you don't.
The United States is very backward when it comes to our measuring systems. Okay. So
yeah.
You know, I studied in the sciences, and so I'm more familiar with the metric system than most Americans.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's actually a logical development of what he says this universe is like. That if if someone can find a solution, a permanent solution, and set up a different kind of pump, it would have to be somewhere else than on Earth. It makes sense to me. And it also, if you claim that the people on Earth are very hidebound, you have to go to the moon because they're different. They're more open-minded. Mm-hmm. They can solve the problem the scientists on Earth can't.
Yeah, well, and there's the kind of scientist infighting too there, where the people on the moon want an electron pump installed on the moon, and people on Earth are... dead set against it. And the reason that when I was thinking about why won't they do it is because they don't know how to set it up. They don't really know how to start it, because it's that process is initiated from the para-universe. And so they can't actually, they can't just do it at will.
No, the part where they get plutonium won't work on the moon for some reason.
Right. Yeah. Well, and that's where they figure there's not a strong enough magnetic field. So they can't be detected in some way.
Yeah, maybe. There's a lot of guesswork there, because in reality, they don't know how the para-universe works, really.
Yeah, yeah.
And isn't that just typical? Free energy, but how does it work? I don't know.
Yeah, but it's good.
Yeah. It's free. Did I say it was free?
Right. Have you ever seen Chicken Run?
Yeah.
And there's the point where the Mr. and Mrs. Tweedy decide to stop farming eggs and start making chicken pies instead. And so they come out and dump all the chicken feed out. And a lot of the chickens are just, oh, chicken feed, my favorite, you know, and they just start stuffing it in their mouths. But Ginger realizes this means they're going to kill us all. Others of them are just like, but it's free food.
Yeah, there is no such thing.
I never thought that I would come up with an analogy to Chicken Run in a science fiction discussion, but I feel like check that one off the list.
What's it called? Shaun the Sheep is a favorite in this household. Yes. So, yeah.
Very good. Yeah.
Including there's a few episodes with aliens.
Yes, yes. When Shaun the Sheep in Farmageddon was.
Oh, yes.
It was Oscar nominated last year. So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. That was good stuff. And that was interesting. The aliens are kind of, you know, blobbish in that movie. So I'm not sure any of them were named Dua, Trit, or Odin. But
no, I'm not sure they have genders, really.
Well, I'm not 100% convinced that the aliens in this have actual genders. And I think, like you said, going with left, right, and mid would probably make more sense today.
Yeah.
Because we can think differently about that just because of the things that we've learned. And science fiction is a good venue for doing that as well.
Yeah, I haven't read Ancillary Justice yet, and I'm very eager to, because it does a thing with gender.
Yes.
I'm trying to. It's not called the Tiptree Award anymore, but the award for texts that do things with gender, bend gender. Some of them are very interesting.
Yeah, I enjoyed that book. And it kind of breaks a man out of the... seeing characters as default male unless you tell me otherwise. Yeah. And it flips it entirely because the pronouns are all female.
Yes.
And so then I was left wondering, well, were those two women who were a couple? Was that a woman and a man? And of course, it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But it makes men uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing.
Yeah. As you mentioned earlier, I read the Danish version, which came out, I don't know, half a year later after the English version.
Wow.
It has a wonderful cover. And I'm not sure how it's related to the book, actually.
Right. Well, it has breasts, so.
It has breasts. maybe that's it. At the time, this particular publishing house really liked doing collages for covers because mm-hmm. the reason that a collage is a new piece of art, so you don't have to worry about copyright. Apparently, they didn't worry about the content of the book.
Right.
So it's I don't know, maybe, yeah, it does say science fiction. There's like a moon and some rocks and stuff and bones, I think. But
yeah,
there's also a naked woman.
Right.
So, a black-painted naked woman.
Right, yeah. The body paint covers a multitude of sins.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there seems to be some representation of maybe the melting of the para-aliens.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
No.
And Easter Island kind of heads as well.
Yes. Oh, it's...
Yeah, that really is a fascinating cover. I'm going to have to use this for the the post on the website. It's so good. I'm not sure what it is, but it's good.
Yep.
Other topics? Anything else you want to talk about?
I don't think so. Okay. No?
Yeah. I read this one. I had finished my previous... book for the podcast while I was on vacation. And then I read the entire first part of this book on the flight back. And I saw that it was a short book, but sometimes short books can be hard to read. There's definitely been a couple here that I've struggled with, like The Big Time was one that I had a hard time getting through, even though it was quite short. So I was delighted that this one was easy to read. Mm. The third part of this book, maybe not quite so easy to read, but 215 pages, you got to figure you're going to get through that eventually. So.
Yeah. I started out saying I would read one part every day. Mm-hmm. And then I figured out that the third part is double the length of the first part. So,
yes.
Bad plan.
Yeah. Yeah. You end up in that third part longer than you think it should be.
Yeah.
So it was interesting in this one that when it switched over to the second part, it's a long time before it ties back into the first part.
Yes.
And that can be a little disorienting, especially if you're reading them in separate magazines.
Yeah.
Like, oh, wait, is this related?
Yeah.
Probably delightful surprise, actually.
I've tried reading some of the big books by Peter F. Hamilton, and I got stuck because he started introducing new threads without telling me how they were connected to what I already knew. Yeah. So I had to stop. Don't do that. Don't do it a lot.
Final thoughts on this book?
We didn't talk about it a lot, but the climate change angle is very important, I think.
I think so.
This idea that 50 years on and we're still doing the same thing.
Yeah, and any plans that we're making for alleviating things are decades away.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a story in Danish newspapers right now because people in Germany have drowned because their rivers suddenly grew 8 meters taller, you know.
Wow.
8 yards. The village didn't prepare for that. Right. And suddenly Danes can say, oh, climate change is something that's about us.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Right.
You didn't know that?
Up until now, it's just those people on the coasts.
You know? Yeah. Greenland, maybe. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Or Pacific Islands, you know.
Yeah.
We don't have to care about those people.
No.
It's kind of sad how relevant the discussion in this book about the electron pump is to climate change and any number of things. So, you know, just even without taking climate change into account, just the energy dependency, you know, on oil and on petroleum is is something that, and it's possible that he was going more for that in this book.
Yeah. And pollution and atomics and
right.
that kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, final thoughts from me. I enjoyed this one. I want to thank you for picking it. So this is the first Hugo Award awarded after my birth, because I was born in 1972. So,
oh,
yeah.
Yeah, I've never tried going back. What? Let me see. Oh, The Moon is a Harsh Mistress is from my birth year. Nice. Well, what do you know? I like Heinlein too, so.
Yeah, he can be a little polarizing, but I enjoyed that one. Well, Lisa, I really want to thank you for coming on the podcast. It was nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too. Well, it's always a bit weird to, because you've been in my ear holes for a long time. It's fun to talk to you for real.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Before we sign off, where can people find you?
Yeah. I have a website called stuff.omadon.dk. And if you're a Mike Oldfield fan, you know exactly how Omadon should be spelled. It's his third album. I have an article up that I wrote while I was preparing for this podcast. And I am on Twitter, and I can't remember my handle right now.
If you can send it to me, I'll put it in the
sure.
notes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was great talking to you. Really, really nice meeting you, and I'm sure we'll interact down the line.
Okay. Right, bye.
Bye. Well, everybody, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Lisa, and I'll put all her links in the show notes, so be sure to check that out. As always, if you're enjoying the podcast, then I encourage you to leave a review in whatever platform you use to listen to it. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you can retweet the episodes, share them on social media with your friends, and you can also go to patreon.com/hugospodcast if you want to support the podcast financially. And I think that'll about do it for this time, so thank you so much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kuske.